Do you like this tune, Sid Griffin?
I like this tune a great, great deal. And I'm so pleased you know it's Eugene Record. It is an amazing name.
Great name.
And also, can I just say that I don't seem to recall having heard either of the cover versions by MC Hammer or the Baron Knights. And I sincerely hope that's a state of affairs that continues.
Sid Griffin is in the house. You've had a fraught journey to the office this afternoon, haven't you?
Well, if you'd like a detailed reconnoitering on the 390 bus. Am I your man or what?
Well, it broke down, did it? And you've had to walk through the hot streets.
Certainly the hot streets, which is... and they are hot today. The asphalt was blurring before my very eyes. I thought I saw an oasis. It was incredible.
Right.
Well, don't worry, Sid. We'll carry on a little later than we planned. So you settle yourself down.
Bless your heart.
Okay, well, we'll have some prints, and then you can take up the story.
Yeah!
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to get through this thing called life. Electric word, life, it means forever, and that's a mighty long time. But I'm here to tell you, there's something else. The afterworld. A world of never-ending happiness. You can always see the sun. Day or night.
Let's go crazy. Prince and the Revolution. Sid Griffin is with us. And Prince was was he a central figure or was he a kind of peripheral figure on what came to be known as the Paisley Underground?
Okay.
Sid, can you hear me?
Yes, I just heard you.
Okay, Sid. No, what we're saying
quiet
is...
for a second.
Prince and the Revolution there. Was Prince kind of a central figure in the Paisley Underground, or what became known as that? Or was he more of a kind of peripheral figure?
He was a central figure to two acts, the 3 o'clock and their later incarnation, the last couple three albums. And, of course, the Bangles. He was instrumental in getting them into the charts. Mm. Instrumental. And without the help of Prince, I think it would have been a tough one. But that Manic Monday, wow, what a booster that was.
Tell us about that scene, then. So where are we? What year does it begin? And we're in Minneapolis. Tell us about the scene, what the clubs were like, and how you all came to sort of, you know, be doing roughly different versions and variants, but roughly sort of singing from the same hymn sheet.
Well, what happened was, I don't know why, it's West Hollywood, an unincorporated part of Los Angeles. It's now incorporated, but at the time it was an open season. There was no West Hollywood this or West Hollywood that. It was unincorporated territory dating back to the 30s, and they had a lot of gangsters there. Mm. So I don't know why you had native Los Angelinos like the Bangles, the Peterson sisters and Susanna Hoffs and Mickey Steele, Michael Steele to some of us. Mm-hmm. And you had Steve Wynn of the Dream Syndicate. And then you had these sort of cactus heads of Green on Red. And you had people like myself coming down from the South and Steve McCarthy of the Long Riders, later a Jayhawk, come from the South. And we all ended up not only in the same town, you guys, and you're wonderful listeners, but the same neighborhood. I can't put enough emphasis on that. The same 6-block area of West Hollywood. Now, was everybody in that neighborhood? Well, no. But so many of us were that it was just incredible. You'd walk down the street and see John Doe and Xene of X, and you could see Steve Wynn, and you could see so many, just everybody, some of the Green on Red guys, most of the Long Riders, most of this, the Bangles, blah, 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 blah. Michael Quersill, a lot of his posse. And that's the 3 o'clock guy, the very guy that came out with the term the Paisley Underground back when he was in a band called Salvation Army. And it wasn't just the time and the place. It was a really finite time in a really small place. And what I really like about it is the weather was great. Everyone liked guitar music. No one was really into synthesizers. The punk thing, none of the people I've just mentioned were sort of angry enough to be punks, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
Everybody was... I hate to say that we're politically naive or uninvolved, but we just didn't have that burning brick throwing anger. We didn't write those kinds of songs. Obsessed with guitars, obsessed with one band or another from the 60s, and not wanting to be retro, but wanting to bring that sound back. It all happened, and what I'm really chuffed about 30 years on down the line is, I'll be reading in a book and it'll say something like, you know, there were these great scenes of rock and roll. Memphis, 1954. Mm. Liverpool, 1962, 63. San Francisco, 1966, 67. And then it'll say something like, you know, London, 76. And all of a sudden it'll go, Los Angeles, 1981, 84. And I'll go, yay, that's
me. The Paisley Underground scene.
I'm in with Sun Records and the San Francisco Psychedelics. Yoo-hoo.
Had you all arrived at the music you loved independently? Or was there a kind of sharing of stuff once you were all hanging out there?
Well, this is the weird thing, Stuart, that I think is pretty much unique to Los Angeles. In New York, you formed in basements of various, or on the roofs of various tenements and so on and so forth, maybe in some bohemian, fashionable little East Side bistro. In London, you'd have formed in perhaps pubs or a student union, the Nelson Mandela student union of this or that university.
Yeah.
In Los Angeles, and everyone's going to, in Britain's going to roll their eyes at this one. Drum roll. We formed at barbecues. There were outdoor afternoon parties, and you'd be sitting there with your veggie burger or whatever it is you're eating, and the guy next to you would say something, something, something. I play guitar as well. I want to have a band as well. Well, so what in Los Angeles? Then all of a sudden he'd say, I like the Buffalo Springfield. I like the Birds. I like the Sex Pistols and the Clash. It'd be great if there's sort of the power of one and the melodicism of the other. And this just scene happened. I know it sounds stupid, and I should say it was the backstage, the Whiskey a Go-Go, or while we were jamming with so-and-so, but it was barbecues and these sort of Sunday and Saturday afternoon parties, which were just endless and beautiful.
Well, funnily enough, I think both you and I will be able to identify slightly with that, because it's something we don't have very, but at Austin, Texas, and South by Southwest,
indeed,
there are some out-of-town sort of barbecues where four bands will play. We went to one and saw the Earlys there, in, just in a kind of somewhat backyard out of town. Yeah. So I do know that scene you mean a little tiny bit.
I don't know why rock and roll has to be in some dingy, horrible nightclub that smells of wee, sweat, and tobacco. Why can't it be outdoors and all this other stuff?
Well, the reason here, Sid, is that because we'd only have 4 days a year where we could invent rock and roll.
And they're happening right now.
Exactly.
Right now.
Exactly, yeah, but you'd rather the better weather for it. So, I mean, did it coalesce into a scene quite quickly? Were you aware that it was a scene?
Very much so. For one reason, we had our help. Los Angeles is the second biggest media center in the United States outside of New York City, of course. So for one thing, we had the media telling us it was. Mm. But it was a bit like Dustin Hoffman in that cowboy film when he looks at the Inquisitor and says, we weren't playing engines, we was engines. It was like that. I mean, I knew it going on. It sounds like rose-colored glasses, but looking at it through rose-colored glasses, but I knew.
You were wearing rose-colored glasses, weren't you?
Wearing rose-colored. They were clear lenses, gentlemen, that I took a permanent magic marker and drew on the inside, because I knew it 8 feet away or more. It looked like, hey, he's got rose-tinted glasses.
Yeah.
I made them. But I knew at the time that this was heavenly, that these would one day be this golden time of my life and this memory. But I sort of thought it would be that, if you will allow me a glib phrase, when I was a senior citizen, perhaps even in a nursing home. I didn't realize in just 10 or 20 years, certainly now 30, that it would be such a big deal. And it was. It was heavenly. And the other thing, let me just throw this in, is everyone was really friendly. Mm. And I lent amps and guitars to people that, you know, just I knew that guitar and the amp would come back. And I knew it would come back in good shape. And I knew if someone ripped a screen or a tube was shattered, they'd pay for it. Mm. And that went on and on and on. And we had our own little hippie sort of quasi-commune thing. I lent extraordinary things to people, and 2 or 3 days later, the guy said, oh, yeah, here it is back, man. I didn't think twice about it.
Who were the first band that kind of got it? You know, there's always in a scene like that, the race to get a record deal or to get a record on the radio. So who were the leading scenesters in the early days?
Anyone that says the Bangles weren't out front from the get-go is wrong. They like all of us, were pretty rough with a wonderful girl named Annette Zelinskis on bass back in the early days. Mm. But if you'll allow me, gentlemen, to use a great West Hollywood show business phrase, they had fairy dust sprinkled on them. Even in the early days when they were rough, they had fairy dust sprinkled on them. I saw a guy named Dwight Yoakam around 1983 or 84, and I thought, he's got the fairy dust sprinkled on him, albeit in a country and western manner. And they had the fairy dust sprinkled on them. Then once Miles Copeland and so many of their, I don't need to name all their management team, but Mike Gormley and some terrific people all got on board, I knew something good was probably going to happen, even though they're still pretty rough. Then Mickey Steele joins because Annette quits. By the way, I am the one that put Mickey Steele up for the Bengals bass playing job. Thank you very much. Thank you. A round of applause. And
you were the Larry Palms of the Paisley Underground. Yeah.
Parnes, Schilling, and Pence.
That's what he called.
And I knew. And then, of course, that got Prince in on the act, because he seemed to think, quite rightly so, that Susanna Hoffs was one of the sexiest women in America.
Yeah.
And then it was just none of us were going to catch up with that. That train was leaving the station. vacation, and none of us were going to catch up with it.
Well, we'll talk a little bit more about this in the next half of the show, and particularly your Please. Encounter with Prince, which we're fascinating, because there are so few reported encounters with Prince, really, so we want to know more about that. But Lauren Laverne, in fact, was there hoping we were going to play this. We're going to play the Bangles and their version of September Girls. You mentioned yes. Buffalo Springfield and the Byrds. Were Big Star a sort of prime influence as well?
Oh, Big Star were huge with that scene. I'm the odd man out. I'm of the opinion Big Star have about 6 or 7 A-plus Godhead top-notch songs.
And this
the rest
is one
of their
them.
Catalog's pretty dodgy. Yeah. This is certainly one of them. And I actually think Gary Stewart of Rhino Records, or maybe Mickey Steele, was the one that first played it to me. It's perfection, pop music perfection.
That's the Bangles version of the classic by Big Star, September Girls.
Indeed so. And we'll talk more with Sid Griffin after Hot Chip.
BBC Radio 6 Music.
Chip, Dark and Stormy. Sid Griffin is back with us, and yep. We're talking about the Paisley Underground scene of West Hollywood. A lot of people interested in hearing it. Anthony Keynes, long-time Long Riders fan. Andrew Tiff, painting portraits in Walsall, says, I first saw the Long Riders on Whistle Test and thought they were incredible.
I think I remember that.
I've carried a C90 around of State of Our Union for well over 20 years, tape from Walsall Library. I've no longer got a tape player. It, famously, it was never released on CD, he says.
He's wrong. Prima Records, yeah, Sid Griffin's label, released it for about 6 months, sold out, couldn't get a reissue license. That was okay. That, but it was out briefly.
Dave Woodcock in Market Harbour wants belated congratulations because he saw you at Portsmouth Poly in 1985. And as you leaned over and played a guitar solo, he saw a new mouth organ in your back pocket and he thought I could nick that, but he didn't. So he wants a pat on the back.
He's belated. A stand-up guy.
Yeah. Pete and Celine say, tell Sid we're looking forward to seeing him at the Soul Party in Kent on the 27th.
Summer of Love. Yeah. It's Soul Party in Kent, yeah.
The best little
July
festival on the planet. Ray in Romford said, hi, Rob Mac. He's a big fan of the Paisley Underground, into bands like 3 O'Clock, Rain Parade, Long Riders and Dream Syndicate. We could never quite understand the Prince connection. And so, I mean, the Prince connection was, at his most basic level, he turned up because he wanted to get off with Susanna Hoffs, really,
well,
did he?
That is the given, the accepted knowledge. I mean, I'm hardly a Prince insider, but yeah. That was
understandable.
Yes. I don't know if you all realize, Susanna Hoffs is an important name in American showbiz now. The Bangles are out playing. I saw them play September 2011 in London. They were great.
So it's three of that four, but not Mickey Steele.
Not
right?
Mickey Steele. But you can imagine, in fact, Rain Parade are back together. I should throw that in there. But you can imagine in the 80s, or perhaps you can't, Susanna was a big, big name in the late 1980s in America. So much so that I remember it. I was watching Saturday Night Live, and the late night comedian Dennis Miller, one of the not ready for prime time players at that time, did a joke, and it was at Susanna Hoffs' expense, and he didn't say Bangles. He just said Susanna Hoffs, and she was the punchline. It was this very soft, innocent, sweet joke, but I mean, I thought, my God, she's a household name, and at least those hipsters that are watching this show, because he didn't say Bangles. He just said, here's my Susanna Hoffs imitation, and he did this little flirty thing she would do in videos, and I thought, my God, she is a big name, and so, of course, Prince would have noticed her. I mean, she was, they were terrifically attractive, very talented band. They, as I said, they had the fairy dust sprinkled on, which is something you either have or you don't.
But you encountered Prince at one of their gigs, didn't you?
Well, I had a real brush with greatness with Prince. What happened was they were playing the Hollywood Palace, not the Hollywood Palladium, the Hollywood Palace the Bangles were. And it was the end of a tour, some celebratory thing. Maybe they were getting their gold records or platinum albums, maybe. And the place is going bananas. And because I was roommates in a big house with a platonic roommate, she had her own room with the great Debbie Peterson, their drummer. And I knew Mickey and all that. I was invited to the gig. Joe Stella, my dear friend in Chicago, roommate from the Windy City, he was their main roadie. So I'm standing in the wings talking to Joey going, God, they're gonna be even bigger. They're huge. This place is going nuts. And Joey was saying these roadie-type things to the side of his mouth like, yeah, you should have seen Oklahoma City. Woo! Stuff like that. And this little tiny guy says, hi, Joey. And I almost didn't see him. And I don't mean to, it sounds like I'm belittling the great talent, because I've seen him. I saw him four times, all in the 1980s, mind-boggling.
Yeah.
And I mean, paying money for a ticket.
Yeah.
And I heard this soft voice go, hi, Joey. And Joey goes, are you going to play the encore? And I'm 6'2½. I didn't see anybody. I went, me? And Joey goes, not you, him. And I looked over, and there's this very small guy. I don't think I'm being cruel here or inaccurate by saying Prince is not a tall guy. He was wearing what we call stack heels, like he's in the suite or something, circa 1973. And he's wearing very thick-soled boots as well, yet he's still struggling to be much over 5 feet tall. And he was there wasn't an ounce or a speck of body fat on him. But having said that, it was sort of like a 12-year-old. He was very small, you know, small chest, small arms, small legs, small buttocks, small feet. He's a little guy. Mm. And with a big head. And and this little tiny voice, he was smiling and making great eye contact, exactly what you wouldn't think he was doing. And he's wearing no shirt, as his want.
Yeah.
But one of those matador...
Like a bolero jacket.
Is that what it's called, a bolero?
So. I'm going to go out this evening dressed like that. Yeah.
If I had the figure, I'd be on Oxford Street now. And he, you know, he's a charismatic-looking guy. And skin tight, sprayed on some kind of white trouser. And Joey goes, well, what do you want? You want a Telecaster? You want this? You want that? You didn't bring one of those liar loot-looking guitars, did you? And Prince goes, I'll never forget. He says, Joey, give me something that screams. And he meant it in the way a heavy metal guy or a guy in Metallica wants a guitar that makes a racket. But instead of saying, hey, give me a guitar that screams, it came out, as I've said earlier, like a 12-year-old asking for more sprinkles on the top of his ice cream cone. It was just funny. Give me something that screams. And I've never forgotten it. And also, I don't remember shaking his hand, but there was polite chit-chat with him making eye contact. And then, of course, no entourage. I think his driver may double as a bodyguard, but the driver was just some nice Italian-American guy standing there. And then Prince went out, and the place went bananas. But there's no... there's no supermodels or body, just, you know, a guy on his own. He did have a driver, and he went out, and the place went bananas. Mm-hmm. And I would also like to interject, he's a cracking guitar player.
Of course.
The thing is, the Prince, people forget, when he emerged, I mean, he blew my mind because he was an incredible musician, an incredible variety of styles, who could dance. You know, he was like...
Yes, I agree.
He was like James Brown meets Stevie Wonder meets... He was incredible, wasn't he? You know.
Well, you all mentioned Minneapolis earlier. He had an open audition in Minneapolis once. I think it was at what is it called? 7th Avenue, the great venue there. And a friend of mine went, an Indianapolis guy who's a wise guy, an American wise guy, and he's a bit of a plaid shirt, Kurt Cobain, ripped jeans guy. And he sat down and Prince says, what do you play? And he just played this country and western thing, sort of like... I don't know. He's got a dumb, mean sense of humor, kind of taking the PISS. And Prince smiled and jumped in. He had that lute, lyre-looking guitar, and he played these amazing country and western licks. And my friend said, I had my tail between my legs. The guy can pick a little C&W. He is a really good, broad, knowledgeable musician.
Did everybody sort of make the break out of the local scene to sort of national success? I mean, there's still names we're talking about now, so it seems that everybody got a deal.
What was great? Let's look at it this way. The original Paisley Underground was the Salvation Army, later the 3 o'clock. One of those gentlemen is now in Paul McCartney's band, and they did real well for a while. They're on IRS and all that stuff. Then the Bangles, originally the She Bangs, briefly, which I wanted them to stay with the She Bangs. Mm. And then they were the Bangs, they were the Colors and all this, and then they stayed with the Bangles. They did very, very well. Rain Parade made a huge mark, didn't sell many records, but are back together today. Then the Dream Syndicate with Steve Wynn, Dennis Duck, and the guys, and they were pretty much unique. And then you threw in Green on Red and the Long Riders doing our thing. Other than the Bangles, nobody sold any real records, but everyone seemed to have had some influence in their genre. And we had the glory of not just being at barbecues in Southern California. I would see these guys in Stockholm or the Columbia Hotel here in London, not far from where I speak, or perhaps in Rome or Japan or whatever. And it was... I've told my friends this. Everyone should that's interested in pop music should one day at least briefly be in a band where people scream your name and where you walk down Tottenham Court Road and there's your buddy from a fellow band in your hometown. Everyone should have that experience. It's a marvelous one.
As a scene, was it short-lived? Was it almost kind of one glorious summer?
Maybe three glorious summers Once everyone got signed, Mark Stewart, you know, once everybody got signed, you guys, the six bands are on six different major labels and you know, it just became diffuse. And there is, we have to say this, an element of competition that enters in.
Of course.
I've always said I'd rather make the $1 million and get the gold record than anybody in this room. But if it's not me, I'm glad it's you guys. And everyone would always laugh at that in L.A. And that's the way I felt. I wish the Long Riders had gone through the roof. They didn't. But I am so pleased my dear friend the Bangles did go through the roof. And I got to see it as close as you could be without being in the band. And it couldn't happen to some groovier, better people. And that's one of the great glories of this. I haven't mentioned anybody that's a T-U-R-D yet.
Yeah. I can personally vouch for the fact that it had global reach as well, because briefly in the mid-1980s, I was in a band in Wigan called the Young Mark Twain, who were essentially a Paisley Underground band relocated implausibly to Wigan, where we hardly ever had any barbecue parties. Right, yeah. But it was essentially
but
the same
thing. Great name for a band.
Yeah. Well, listen, it's been fascinating to learn about this. So we're going to finish off by playing The Long Riders.
Yay!
And I Had a Dream.
Stephen McCarthy wrote this one.
All right, then.
My favorite Long Rider song.
And you didn't even write it.
And you didn't write it. That's very decent of you,
but
Sid.
I play the 12-string on it. Although I must confess, he showed me the parts to play.
And will the Long Riders resurface? You say the Rain Parade are back together. I know you have had reunions.
Steve Hammonds will allow me to say it. There's a Long Riders box set. Steve, I hope this is okay. There's a Long Riders box set coming out next year, and we'd like to do some shows to back up the box
set. Great.
But because the guys live so far apart on the globe, it's hard to have a tour, so you're stuck with the Cold Porters.
Right. Okay.
Bless you all.
All right, Sid, lovely talking
lovely
to you.
Lovely to see you, Sid.
Thanks, guys. Okay. Hi, Stuart. Hi, Mark. You are the greatest.
From 1984 on the album Native Sons, Sid and the Long Riders, and I Had a Dream.
Change. But you'll never listen. Just turn your head.